It is Wednesday, February 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, China establishes a missile system on a contested island in the South China Sea. We get reaction.
We shouldn't be surprised, but by the same token, I don't think we should be overly alarmed at it.
The United States and Cuba announce a new agreement on daily direct flights, and we hear why singer Taylor Swift dominated the 2016 Grammy Awards. It's all ahead. Taiwan has confirmed an earlier U.S. report that China has deployed batteries of surface-to-air missiles on Woody Island in the Paracels in the South China Sea. If true, the commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, Admiral Harry Harris, is quoted as saying it would be a clear indication of militarization, contrary to a pledge last year by President Xi Jinping not to militarize the region. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi Wednesday dismissed the reports as an attempt to create news stories, but he said China's limited and necessary self-defense facilities are consistent with the right to self-preservation and self-protection. Fox News cited satellite images showing two batteries of HQ-9 missiles and a radar system. And the publication The Diplomat reports China is building a helicopter base on Duncan Island, also in the Paracels. These developments surfaced the same day President Obama, hosting a summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, reaffirmed its strong commitment to a peaceful resolution of maritime disputes.
We discussed the need for tangible steps in the South China Sea to lower tensions, including a halt to further reclamation, new construction, and militarization of disputed areas. Freedom of navigation must be upheld, and lawful commerce should not be impeded. I reiterated that the United States will continue to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, and we will support the right of all countries to do the same. We will continue to help our allies and partners strengthen their maritime capabilities, and we discussed how any disputes between claimants in the region must be resolved peacefully through legal means, such as the upcoming arbitration ruling under the UN Convention of the Law of the Seas, which the parties are obligated to respect and abide by.
Brad Glosserman of the Hawaii-based Pacific Forum Asia-Pacific Security Think Tank tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the missile deployment underscores China's belief that these islands are important outposts to project power and that Beijing is prepared to defend them.
We shouldn't be surprised, but by the same token, I don't think we should be overly alarmed at it.
Would that put U.S. aircraft at risk?
In theory, yes, it would, but I cannot believe that the Chinese would be so foolish and so trigger-happy as to actually employ or deploy these systems. The Chinese have insisted that these are their territory and that they therefore will countenance no challenge to their sovereignty claims. The United States, of course, is, without taking a legal position on the sovereignty claims, has nevertheless made it clear that they believe that these are artificial features that do not incur the territorial waters that come with certain types of features, and therefore that we've had these with the Freedom of Navigation Ops for the last couple of months, and we've made it clear that we are going to expect to continue and expect that whoever the claimant is, and it's important to recognize that the U.S. ships have not been just sailing through Chinese claim waters, the Philippine and Vietnamese as well, that they will countenance no interruption or marginalization, if you will, of the U.S. ability to have freedom of navigation operations. And so I think what the Chinese are doing is doing what they can to backstop their claim as they see it. There is no basis for this in international law, and to provide meat behind the words that they've used. But I cannot see them using these systems as a demonstration effect. It's just too risky, too dangerous, and too pointless.
Well, then why would they deploy them?
Because I think they're responding to domestic pressure, that they've clearly backed themselves into a corner insofar as they have to continue to demonstrate that they are protecting these islands. And the issue of the United States is not that we want to claim these islands, is that we want to make sure that no one claims these islands and claims these waters as a means of impeding the navigation of our vessels. And so the Chinese deployments are ways that they can, I suppose, threaten vessels or planes that might go into their waters, but they certainly would never go so far as to actually use them.
This report surfaces as President Obama held an extraordinary two-day summit with ASEAN leaders in Rancho Mirage, California, They issued a statement about the South China Sea, urging an easing of tensions, but didn't directly mention China.
I think that that's a lowest common denominator approach. And remember that there are six different countries that are claiming various parts, have territorial disputes in the South China Sea. And the fact of the matter is the United States would do well to argue that we are, and to insist, as all claimants, that all disputes must be resolved peacefully. And the freedom of navigation operations that were done did not just enter into Chinese water, but also went into Vietnamese and Philippine waters as well. And I think our point is that none of these claims are valid insofar as they give each government a right to encroach on U.S. FONOPS, as they're called. And so we will continue. And thus, the issue is more generally a way, a principle to resolve disputes rather than it is singling out of one particular country that is acting in ways we don't like.
That's Brad Glosserman of the Pacific Forum. He says the U.S. is committed to legally challenging Beijing's claim to almost all of the South China Sea, as it is to similar claims by other countries. In October, the Permanent Court of Arbitration at The Hague ruled it has jurisdiction in a case brought by the Philippines over China's presence on islands with its economic exclusion zone. Well, joining me now is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending today.
The Grammy Awards were Monday night in Los Angeles, and while there's a lot of social media conversation about the night's top winners, including Taylor Swift and Bruno Mars and Ed Sheeran, there's a lot of conversation also about artists like The Weeknd and Wiz Khalifa. Now, those artists were actually the top draws on social media, according to Adweek. The biggest draw on Facebook was Wiz Khalifa, the rapper. He had the most conversations about him on that social medium during the Grammy Awards. The Weeknd, who was up for Album of the Year and several other awards, had the most conversation on Twitter. Now, that doesn't mean that Taylor Swift and Kendrick Lamar didn't have a lot of conversation about them. They did. In fact, according to Adweek, Taylor Swift brought in about 67,000 new Twitter followers during the awards and over 120,000 new Instagram followers. So she did pretty well for herself on social media on awards night, as well as garnering quite a few prestigious Grammys. But it wasn't just the artists that were doing quite well. It was the brands as well. Notably, Lady Gaga's partnership with Intel. They did a nice 2-minute long commercial highlighting their new products using Lady Gaga. And that paid off well for them. They were actually among the top 5 discussed companies on Facebook, and they were number 3 on Instagram. So a new way that music artists are combining with corporate entities on social media to get those brands out and sell more products. And a story out of the UK, sometimes, you know, people should just not go on social media and share what they're thinking. And in the case of one gentleman, Daniel Sledden, he definitely shouldn't have done that. He was actually sentenced to a suspended sentence over a drug offense in the UK. And how did he celebrate? He took to his Facebook and, well, he posted some choice words about the judge in that case. Well, moral of the story, he shouldn't have done that because guess what? The judge has now called him back into court next week after seeing this Facebook post where he used some unsavory language towards her. Needless to say, he's not going to get another suspended sentence. Just goes to show, if you have some thoughts, even if it's on social media, use the old rule. If you have nothing nice to say, don't say anything. I'm Andrew Palcheski with the Social Media Report at VOA News in Washington.
Thank you, Andrew, for those words of advice. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A team of experts at North Carolina's Duke University are tweaking a simple new blood test they've developed that will allow medical professionals to determine whether a respiratory illness stems from a viral or bacterial infection. Bacterial infections are usually treated with antibiotics, which are ineffective against viral infections. The test will help doctors pinpoint the appropriate antibiotics to fight the infection if it's bacterial in nature and consider treatments other than antibiotics if caused by a virus. The scientists who are developing this blood test say they hope that it will help stem the trend of overprescribing antibiotics, which some say has led to an increase of antimicrobial-resistant bacterial strains. One of the lead researchers, Dr. Ephraim Salik, said that about 3/4 of respiratory patients are prescribed antibiotics despite the fact that the majority actually have viral infections. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is America's International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear about conditions for Syrian refugees on the Turkish border. On Tuesday, the United States and Cuba announced an agreement that will permit up to 110 daily U.S. commercial flights to Cuba. It's the latest sign of improving ties following the reestablishment of diplomatic relations last July. It will allow the first American commercial flight service to the communist-ruled country in more than 50 years. Currently, only charter flights provide regular air service between the two countries. U.S. Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox calls the aviation agreement a critically important milestone in greater engagement, although tourism will remain limited due to Cuba's antiquated infrastructure and the U.S. trade embargo, which remains in effect. Rodrigo Melciero Diaz, Cuban Minister of Foreign Trade and Investment, said he hoped the embargo would be lifted soon and pledged U.S. companies would not be discriminated against.
In our side, we are going to treat the American companies the same we treat all the others from all over the place, the places in the world. We are not going to discriminate the American companies. We are not going to make the processes more complicated or whatever. We want, I explained today during lunch and before in the other meetings, that we need the foreign investment to come to Cuba. It's an important component to promote the economic development of Cuba. So we are not creating barriers. We want them to come. We are promoting this. So it would be stupid on our side to delay things. No, we don't want to do that.
Rice University Latin American analyst Mark Jones tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that until the embargo is lifted by Congress, American travel to Cuba will remain limited.
Right now, travelers still have to maintain the fiction that they're going for educational reasons or religious reasons or business reasons, not for pure tourism. Although that's moved from a strict requirement to something of a fig leaf where the Treasury Department doesn't really check it much anymore.
Will that limit travel?
Well, it certainly limits it somewhat in that restriction is still there. And so if you are going for pure tourism, you either don't go to Cuba or you're deceptive when applying for permission to go to Cuba. For the average traveler who's debating between traveling to Cuba or traveling to the Bahamas or to Mexico, that will represent a extra added hurdle that will discourage some leisure travelers. On the other hand, the mystery of traveling to Cuba, something that people haven't done much recently, that should at the same time counteract that by making Cuba a little more attractive and exotic of a destination.
It comes just one day after an Alabama-based company is going to be allowed to manufacture small tractors in Cuba. The pace seems to be picking up, and there is one report that suggests the Obama administration, before it leaves office within a year, is trying to make the trend irreversible for a future president.
Well, I think President Obama already has made this trend irreversible. It's like a snowball that's rolling downhill. The president's pushed it, and it's now at such a pace that no one could get in the way of it. And no one really wants to, because outside of a small, isolated group in Miami-Dade County and a few other places, no one really opposes relaxing ties with Cuba and restoring normal diplomatic and commercial relations with the country. It's only a very small minority of the U.S. population that actually is blocking it. An overwhelming majority of Americans want to see a normalization of ties with Cuba. And that's what President Obama is delivering with this. And it's only a process that's going to become more and more normalized as we move in the future. At this point, President Obama has moved things so much forward that it's virtually impossible for anyone to go back unless there's some unexpected development inside of Cuba, such as a crackdown.
And Mark Jones says he doesn't anticipate the U.S. trade embargo, first imposed in 1960 and strengthened in 1962, will be lifted anytime soon. And even when it is lifted, he doesn't believe it will result in the democratization of Cuba. Rather, he believes Havana will likely adopt the Chinese model, coupling economic liberalization with continued tight political control and limited civil liberties under the Communist Party. Well, the world has witnessed the migrant crisis stemming from the continuing violence in Syria. Recently, I spoke with Man, a Syrian International Rescue Committee worker based in Gaziantep, Turkey. His surname cannot be disclosed for security reasons. Man works in the Turkish city, which is about 97 kilometers north of Aleppo, Syria. I asked him to describe the situation for Syrians fleeing the violence in their homeland.
The last 5 days, like a huge displacement in the field due to advances the armed group or the government forces on the ground. This is a result in a huge displacement for the people. You know, during this displacement, the people just holding their basic things with them and walking for more than 3 kilos to reach the border. But you can't imagine. At the first point, they are just fleeing to reach a safe area. Then the needs raised at the border or other location, like we can say Azad City or Afrin, all the people displaced.
Now, you mentioned the situation there when people get through, those are able to make it through, and the situation in the camps. Are they able to care for the people that get through?
The camp area is different. The camp already before the displacement is fully occupied, the camp. Many people just go to the camps, to this area. The camps, let's say we are as IRC serving one camp with clean drinking water. So we are monitoring the population inside. From this displacement, let's say the camp population was around 3,500. The camps received additional 1,500. So each tent inside the camp was occupied by one family. Now each tent is occupied by three or more families. Just to give you like a more clear issue about the camp, just the tents in the camp have just 5 meter length and 3 meter width. So imagine how the people. And the you know, the Syrian family as are big, let's say. There's some families with 10 members or 7 members. So imagine the situation for those people. Even by more offensive or airstrikes on the ground, even the people in the camps will flee to the border.
Man, he's a Syrian working with the International Rescue Committee in Gaziantep, Turkey, near the Syrian border. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Well, the Grammy Awards took place Monday in Los Angeles, and the biggest pop star, you can argue about it, but she seemed to be Taylor Swift, she won for Album of the Year. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition Susan Yaki to talk about it.
We're going to talk about Taylor, who, in my opinion, was one of the better opening numbers for the Grammy. She sang her brand new single, which is Out of the Woods, which is the sixth release from her 1989 album. And she looked great. She had this sparkly one-piece bodysuit on and a short bob hair. She looked great. She really looked great. The confetti was flying. And it was a great opening to the show. And speaking of the 1989 album, that's the story, because the biggest award of the night, obviously, that everyone waits to find out, is the Album of the Year. And Taylor made history this year when she got it for the second time.
I wanted to ask you something, because you know this stuff. I read that the Grammys are kind of old because she wins so much. And they thought it was old stuff that she won, and they thought that the rap singer should have won.
Kendrick Lamar? Well, you know, there's different schools, different camps. People believe different things. And there will always be, you know, who should have won the Super Bowl.
Right.
You'll always get that, the factions of fans. And I don't think it's, you know, gotten boring or stale or predictable. She only got one Grammy. And so I think she deserved it. The 1989 album produced 6 hits. No other album has produced that many hits. And as I mentioned, the last time she did this was 2010. She was only 20 years old at the time. Her album Fearless won Album of the Year. She's the only female in Grammy history to do that, to win 2 Album of the Year Grammy Awards. The last time it was done, it was 1975. Stevie Wonder did it. So that's how rare it is, and that's how special this particular event was for Taylor Swift. And she gave a great acceptance speech.
Is she going to be like the Cher of her generation?
I don't know, because Taylor Swift is known not so much as a singer, although she is a singer. She's known as a songwriter. I think Cher is not really known as a songwriter.
No, no, no.
But Taylor Swift kind of writes great songs, and a lot of her great songs draw on personal events and experiences, including relationships. A lot of the songs talk about past relationships and leave us all guessing, who was that one about?
I've heard she's a little sensitive about that, though.
Yes, she is. Yes, she is. As a matter of fact, you know, she doesn't want to talk about her personal life too much. She's sensitive on a variety of subjects. You may remember at the MTV Awards in 2009, Kanye West grabbed the microphone out of her hand she was accepting an award, and he said Beyonce had the video of the year. Well, Kanye West has a new song out called Famous that pokes fun of Taylor Swift, and he says he made Taylor Swift famous.
Oh.
And when she got her Best Album Grammy, she said, I want to just say for women all around the world and for artists all around the world, own it. It's yours. You deserve it. She said, I deserve this. No one else gets credit for this but me.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Larry. And let's listen to her song, Blank Space.
Yes, this song was nominated for a Song of the Year.
That's the music of Taylor Swift. Well, that's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Oh my God, look at that face. You look like my next mistake. Love's a game, wanna play. New money, suit and tie. I can read you like a magazine. Winning funny, rumors fly. And I know you heard about me, so hey, let's be friends. I'm dying to see.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. 8 candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a 5th term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aini, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.